regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today. As I mentioned yesterday, we're going to be talking with Barry Todd, a self-defense survivor who wrote a book called To Stand Your Ground, detailing his nightmare, legal nightmare, after he acted to defend his life. I spoke with Barry at the interannual meeting in Atlanta back in, May, I guess it was. And since then, Barry has actually heard from a lot of folks who are either concerned that they might find themselves in a similar situation. He's talked to some folks who have found themselves in that same similar situation. So I thought it'd be good to touch base with Barry and just get an update on, you know, what has gone on over the past few months. And if you missed that interview with Barry back in May, we talk about what actually happened to him more than 10 years ago. And I got to tell you, it is a legal nightmare. So without any further ado, let's get to the conversation with Barry Todd. Take a look and a listen. Barry, thanks so much for joining me on the program. It's good to see you again.
Thank you. Good to see you.
And it sounds like you've had a busy few months since we first connected in Atlanta at the NRA annual meeting.
Oh, yes, most definitely.
Tell me about the reaction that your book, Stand Your Ground, is getting here.
Nothing but positive. Outside a few crazed liberals on social media, it's going great. It became a bestseller in the latter part of June, an Amazon bestseller. So I was shocked that it happened that quick, but it's moving really well.
That's good. You know, and I think one of the reasons why so many people are responding to this is because, you know, this is a legitimate fear, right? That you can act in self-defense. You defended your life, but you are still, you know, in every self-defense circumstance, there's going to be a police investigation. But that concern is that, okay, I acted to defend my life, but I'm still going to get charged with a crime. I still may get put in prison for this, right? I mean, that's a legitimate concern that a lot of gun owners have.
It is. It is. And we're starting to see more and more of it across the country. And it doesn't matter whether you're in a red state or a blue state or whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. It's happening all over the country. I just got done watching a thing that I read about last October, a young man by the name of Spencer in Arkansas. All right. A guy had been stalking his daughter, who was 13 at the time. He was out on probation or not probation, but released pending trial, had 46 felony charges being held on him for child pornography, everything dealing with kids. He's a pedophile. He goes into his daughter's room late one night. She's gone. That guy has shown up, taking her out the window. He jumps in his Ford truck, chases him down, rams him with his car, gets his daughter out there. There's an altercation. He shoots and kills the guy. And now he's going to trial for second-degree murder. It's unbelievable.
Remind folks, if you can, the circumstances of your case.
All right. In a nutshell, this book is for everyone. I want to say that up front, but especially for anyone that has been presumed guilty until proven innocent. Simply, my wife and I were out with some other retired friends. We both were threatened, and then I was viciously attacked, not once, but twice, by two men, one of them wielding a knife. And when the police arrived, they handcuffed me immediately with no investigation, no due process, threw me in jail for 5 days with no medical, never read me my rights, and then charged me with attempted murder and two counts of aggravated assault. And they did all of that, Cam, prior to ever looking at one of the 16 cameras that were in and around the building to show that it was strictly self-defense, even though I told him it was strictly self-defense.
Yeah. So what happened? I mean, were the charges eventually dropped?
Yes. It got sent back to the grand jury four times, Cam. On the fourth time, And they kept getting sent back. I see you laughing, so let me add a little clarity to that. The reason the judge kept sending it back to the grand jury is because the prosecutor would not refuse, for whatever reason, to show the videos and present all the self-defense laws. And when you go to a grand jury, most people don't understand how a grand jury works. It is the prosecutor's playground.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There is no judge. There is no defense. He presents all his evidence the way he wants the charges to come out. And we see it coming across the country. Another example is Daniel Pennycamp, the New York kid.
Yep.
If that prosecutor, Alvin Bragg, had gone into the grand jury and showed the videos from all those people's phones, all right, and taken their statements and presented them to the grand jury, he would have never come out with charges. That grand jury would have never done charges. So he withheld that information from the grand jury so he could take it to trial, all right, because it was a black versus white thing. He was making it out to be that way. And it would have saved him a lot of money. But see, prosecutors are elected. Right. And they have to appease their constituents.
Yeah.
So they don't want to do the honorable thing and present all the evidence, getting the no charges charge, and then letting the guy walk. They'd rather put them and their family through hell so the onus doesn't fall on them.
So getting back to your case, after the fourth time that the grand jury was presented with this case, did they decline to indict once they...
Great question. On the fourth time that the judge sent it back, the prosecutor got very upset in the courtroom, threw his pencil down on the desk, and said, "Your Honor, I demand a preliminary hearing." My attorney was like, "Yes, we want to do that." And for your listeners, if you don't know what a preliminary hearing is, it replaces a grand jury, but it's like a mini trial.
Yeah, you get to actually present your side of the case.
Correct. And you have a judge that has knowledge of the law, knows all the laws. He has the manuals there, and he determines if there's enough probable cause.
Okay.
And so the funny thing was, Cam, we didn't even have to put anything on. We just used the video, and every single one of the prosecution's witnesses recanted their testimony. And at the end of the prosecution's presentation, we haven't put anything on. The judge literally looked at the prosecutor and goes, "You know, watching the video, Mr. Todd was justified in his actions. It doesn't matter whether he was shot him or not. He was justified. He was assaulted. He was attacked." And then he looked at me and he goes, "And probable cause is a low bar to obtain in the United States. And I could argue in court and win that it's even lower in the state of Arizona. But you haven't even come close."
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, I thought about you this past weekend, Barry, because I ran across another story out of Arizona, Prescott, Arizona, actually. I think it was ABC 15 in Phoenix talked about this case. It involves a guy named Matt Masucci. And this happened a couple of years ago. He had gone to his local convenience store. He gets back to his car. This guy gets in his face, basically very belligerently, and threatens him. So Masucci draws his pistol. The guy backs off. Masucci drives away. 4 days later, he's pulled over by police, ordered out of the car at gunpoint, taken into custody on two counts of aggravated assault, one kind of disorderly conduct with a deadly weapon. Turns out the guy who got in his face was an assistant fire chief who apparently was drunk at the time, coming from his brother's funeral. And his wife had called 911, said, "You know, my husband was threatened," basically told this false story. And, you know, you talk again about the surveillance video. So there was video showing some of this, but it took, I guess, you know, a year and a half or so for that video to be enhanced and Masucci's defense attorney to present this to a judge who immediately said, "There's no case here. You know, this guy was acting within his rights." But, you know, the defendant, the armed citizen in this case, Mr. Masucci, he's left not only Prescott, Arizona, he's moved out of the state of Arizona. He felt like he was so many similarities to your story. It felt like he was railroaded. It felt like the prosecutor didn't care about what actually happened, but wanted to get that win, right? And so, like I said, I thought about you this past week when I ran across that story, because as you say, this is more common than we want to think.
Yes. Oh, yeah. It's crazy. We got George Allen that owned a ranch on the east side of Arizona, out in Santa Cruz County out there. And this happened back in 2022. He was out there, huge ranch, guys in his 70s, found an illegal dead with a big gunshot hole in this illegal alien that was coming across his land. Called the police and the Border Patrol. They show up. 2 weeks later, the Santa Cruz County prosecutor charges him with murder. They have no physical evidence. They have no weapon, nothing. He has to mortgage his ranch, ends up losing it, but ends up being found not guilty at the end of the day. But he's already ruined his life.
Right.
And that's what these prosecutors are doing. And the one thing I learned through this whole thing, Cam, and it really shocked me, because I made some errors in how I dealt with it. I believed that you don't need an attorney. If you're right, you tell the police. So I told him it was strictly self-defense. I told him what happened. And the guy comes in after I tell him this. This is 3 or 4 hours after I was the incident happened, early Saturday morning, March 1st, 2014. He comes in and he puts a document in front of me. He says, read this and sign it. I said, well, what is it? He goes, it's a charge sheet. I said, I told you it was strictly self-defense. What am I being charged with? Attempted murder and 2 counts of aggravated assault. I said, again, I told you this was self-defense. I know Arizona law. He goes, well, we have the whole thing on video. I said, great. Have you looked at the video? He said, not yet. Now, being a retired Army Ranger, you can imagine the words that came out of my mouth next. It started with, oh, you're a real intelligent life form. The oxygen's just flowing to your brain. Who the hell gave you a badge? You can't make this stuff up. And then He gets on the stand in the preliminary hearing in the cross-examination, and he literally said, he was honest. He admitted that he never read me my rights. But then he was asked, do you know Arizona's justification defense laws? Do you know that it changed 10 to 15 years ago? And he goes, no. And he goes, and my attorney asked him, well, don't you think that's your responsibility, since you have the authority to arrest people? He goes, no, that's not my responsibility. That's the attorneys and the judges.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And if you read my book, I actually 6 chapters of the 14 chapters in the book are actually the transcripts from that preliminary hearing, unedited, just the way it happened. Yeah. And my lead investigator and attorney told me when we walked in that morning before it started, to go, Barry, this is not going to be a Matlock or a Perry Mason. All right. And I said, okay, well, there were so many astonishing things that happened throughout that 6 hours before the case was dismissed later that day, that afterwards they both came up to me and go, only you would make it like a Matlock or Perry Mason. You'll be shocked at the incompetence you see. And then the other thing that shocked me to the core is the lack of knowledge for the definition and understanding of an American trait, and that's called honor. All right.
Most. What do you mean by that?
All right. Great question. Great follow up there. The most people, when you ask them today, because of the changes in our education system, if you ask them the definition of honor, they give you the definition of integrity, which is doing the right thing when no one's looking. Well, honor is much further than that. Honor is doing the right thing no matter the cost. So, and as I was going through this process, my lead investigator, because I knew some police officers on the force, one of them was a pastor in my church, an associate pastor, and they were asked to come in without me being there and watched the video with my attorney and my lead investigator. All of them did. And my attorney said, and all of them said, wow, he's innocent. You know, you got a great case here. And every one of them were asked, would you be willing to sign an affidavit of what you're seeing in the video and that I follow the law? And every single one of them, Cam, said, I can't go against my brothers in blue. They put loyalty above honor. Yeah. And in the military, we don't do that. We weren't taught that, but they do in police forces. And that's what gives them a really bad taste in their mouth, because they don't hold each other accountable to the same standard that they want all of us held to.
Yeah.
And that's not right. And I'm not saying all police are that way, because there were several federal law enforcement officers that used to work in Arizona that were friends of mine that all signed on the line after they watched the video. One of them, Dennis, comes out of the room. He's laughing. He goes, dude, you got effed. He goes, I'm on your defense team. And he goes, that is unbelievable.
Well, I'm glad that you did find some folks with honor. But, you know, I mean, again, that gets back to the case I was talking about this past weekend, where, you know, again, it seemed like it wasn't necessarily, you know, I got to back my fellow officers, but it was, you know, sort of the small town good old boy network. Right. Yeah. And that comes into play as well. So, you know, you talked about the mistakes that you made. One, again, no matter how justified you were in acting in self-defense, have an attorney, right? Don't do this on your own. You should contact an attorney at the first available opportunity, right?
Yep. And so, don't speak to the cops until you get the attorney there.
Okay. What other advice would you give individuals who find themselves in your unfortunate circumstances where, again, forced to defend yourself?
Number two, because I canceled mine 6 months, a year early, have the coverage. Whether it's Delta Defense, USCCA, or through the NRA, have coverage. The personal side, it cost me almost $400,000. On the professional side, it took me another 5 years to clear my name. It cost us over another $250,000. So altogether, it was between $650,000 to $750,000 of total out-of-pocket dollars. And if you add that on a very simple, small rate of return and the time value of money, that was, you know, $3-5 million of lost resources because of this. So have that coverage. Number three is when you have the attorney, and if you read my book, I actually had to challenge my own attorney. Remember, the attorney works for you. Hold the attorney accountable. Hold your lead investigators accountable. Check their work. I fired the first two investigators that I had within the first month. One of them was recommended by my lead attorney. And even my lead attorney, Michael Kimmer, a great man, he is now deceased. He passed away in 2023. He was one of the two attorneys on the Miranda rights case in 69.
Oh, wow.
All right. So this guy was brilliant. He knew his stuff, but he also skipped a step in the front end where the laws had changed for self-defense, because he had had a lot of white collar crimes in the previous year. So he had not. And so when I went to him and he said he would take the case, he thought Arizona was still an affirmative defense state.
And it has to prove your innocence, right?
Correct.
You're guilty until you prove yourself innocent.
Correct. In self-defense.
Yeah. But
Arizona had switched in 2004 to a justification defense. A lot of listeners know it as the Castle Doctrine, stand your ground, all that. But it's actually the legal term for it is you are now, it's a justification defense state, which means, yeah, I did that, but I was justified. And this is why I was justified. So you can't charge me because of that.
Mm-hmm. And he was not aware of that.
No, I had to, it took me about a year to battle it into him. He goes, what you learn in your CCW is not the law. And I finally sat him down. I said, Mike, who do you work for? He goes, I work for you. I said, okay, I want you to read these laws that I learned in my CCW. And I want you to take your time. They're very short, but I want you to read them. And I handed him my phone. I brought the laws up and he sat there and read them. And then after he gets done reading them, because he did go through them twice, he goes, give me 24 hours. I'm going to give you a call no later than CLB tomorrow. He goes back to his office in Phoenix because he was in Yuma for a grand jury that we had that day. And it came out with a true bill again. He goes back to his office and he has his associate attorney go back and look at all the self-defense laws, which is the step he skipped because he thought he knew them.
Right.
And he calls me up at 4:35 o'clock that next day and goes, Barry, I got you on speaker with Mike. He was my lead investigator, Mike McLaughlin, and Rhonda Neff, his associate. He goes, you were right and I was wrong. The laws had changed and the stuff you learned in your CCW training was the law. So I will be waiving your quarterly fee this coming quarter.
Wow.
And he took it from there and it went through. But you got to be your own advocate and you have to lead your legal team. Do not be afraid to do that. You're the one writing the checks.
You know, again, I hope that everyone in my audience never needs this advice, Barry, but I'm glad that you're offering it. Can you show us your book one more time? Because I want folks to go out and buy this book if they have not got a copy already.
There it is right there. Stand Your Ground, One Man's Self-Defense Nightmare. You can go to our website, standyourgroundbook.com. You can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Dorrance directly. All the proceeds from our book are going to a foundation that was created by my legal team, my wife and I, and some other legal experts, retired police chiefs and stuff, to start helping other people throughout the country. I was blessed because I had the resources and I own a national company that I was able to defend myself. But not everybody's in that same position. Look at Daniel Pennier, this young man in Arkansas. And all these other foundations out there are these lawyers that set this stuff up. It's always after they've been convicted. Well, that's too late. Because then you got to go back and get it cleared, get it expunged. And then we don't want that. We just want to have the resources available to say, hey, and we're starting to interview attorneys in different states to get them on board with us, et cetera. So again, go to standyourgroundbook.com.
All right, Barry, listen, man, I really appreciate you reconnecting with us. I hope we get to do this again in a couple months. I'd love to check back in with you.
I'd love to do it. Thank you, Cam. God bless you. God bless your listeners and may God bless America.
Absolutely. Barry Todd joining us here on Barry and Arms, Cam and Company. My thanks once again to Barry for joining us on the program and for sharing his story, because, I mean, honestly, this is just, you know, it could happen to any of us who are forced to act to protect and defend ourselves at some point. And as you know, Barry says, some of these stories, some of these incidents, it's not uncommon for the charges to be filed before the investigation is done. And it can be a legal nightmare that can cost you hundreds of thousands of dollars to defend your life. All right, let's get to today's armed citizen story, today's good deed of the day and armed citizen report as well. We'll start, however, with our recidivist report. I don't know if this is a true case of recidivism. I don't know if these individuals have a previous criminal history, but I do know that they got probation for attacking Big Balls, the Doge employee who was assaulted on the streets of Washington, D.C. The New York Daily News reports that the two Maryland teenagers who pleaded guilty to assaulting that former Department of Government Efficiency employee back in court on Tuesday for sentencing, the 15-year-old boy and girl arrested back in August in connection with the attempted carjacking and beating of Edward Korestein, a 19-year-old programmer, who's better known by his nickname, Big Balls, the teenage boy, and again, these teens are not being identified because they're juveniles. The teenage boy pleaded guilty to felony assault, robbery, simple assault, was sentenced to 12 months probation. 12 months probation for a felony, violent felony. The 15-year-old girl that pleaded guilty to simple assault, she got 9 months probation. according to WUSA in Washington, D.C. They're not allowed to contact each other. They're not allowed to be in Washington, D.C., except for school, work, or family obligations. They actually live in Maryland. I'm amazed by this. Again, we talk about the problems within the criminal justice system overall, but particularly within the juvenile justice system. 12 months probation for violently assaulting somebody, for trying to car. By the way, Core State had stepped in to apparently stop a carjacking. So he was not the intended victim of the carjacking, but I think, if I recall correctly, he stepped in to defend somebody who was about to be carjacked and then was brutally beaten as a result. And again, what's the punishment? Well, they were arrested back in August. So at most, let's say that they were arrested in August. They have remained in custody between then and now. And then were sentenced to probation. We're talking about August to September, September to October, less than 3 months behind bars at most. Now, I have no guarantee that they spent really any time behind bars. They very well could have been released. In fact, they probably were released to their guardians within hours of being arrested. I know the purpose of the juvenile justice system is not incarceration. It is rehabilitation. I get it. But there does need to be some consequences. Part of rehabilitation is understanding that there are consequences for your action. And in this case, it doesn't sound like there were any consequences at all. I know probation is not nothing, but it's not much. And as we've detailed on so many occasions here, what happens when you violate your probation? Oftentimes, nothing at all, right? Your probation gets extended, but you don't get put in prison. You have to serve the entirety of your original sentence. I'm absolutely disgusted by the sentence handed down here to the individuals who attacked Korstein earlier this year. Today's armed citizen story from the Sunshine State of Florida. The Daytona Beach News Journal reporting on a woman in Deltona who shot her husband in self-defense, wounding him. I believe, by the way, that this is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And in this case, it sounds like this woman was, again, being physically assaulted. 41-year-old Jermaine Jackson showed up at a hospital in Daytona Beach with a gunshot wound to the arm. He ultimately was charged with battery, two counts of violation of probation, as well as making a false report, knowingly giving false information to police. According to deputies in Volusia County, Jackson and his wife were involved in a physical fight at their Deltona home Saturday afternoon. According to the paper, the confrontation escalated to the point where the woman was forced to shoot Jackson in self-defense, according to deputies. Wife said that Jackson had been released in March from prison on a manslaughter charge. Woman said that Jackson was violent, had battered her multiple times. She reported she had to change the locks on the doors to stop Jackson from entering the home. So even though they were still married, I don't know if they were actually living together. If they were estranged, apparently they were not living together at the time because he was trying to force his way into the home, broke through the door. The wife retrieved a firearm, shot through the door, hitting Jackson in the arm. Both Jackson and his wife then left the home in separate vehicles before law enforcement arrived. Jackson found at the local hospital. His wife was found in the parking lot of a McDonald's there in Deltona. And when deputies contacted Jackson at the hospital, he made up a story that he didn't know who shot him. He said he was hanging out with his family at a home in Daytona Beach when a disturbance broke out nearby. There were gunshots fired. He said that's when he realized he'd been shot in the arm, and he didn't know who shot him. Deputies, though, had enough evidence to show that Jackson was shot at the couple's home there, at least the woman's home in Deltona. The paper also reports that Jackson served 5 years in prison for shooting and killing a 43-year-old man during a card game at a car wash in November of 2020. He was released from prison in March and was placed on 5 years probation at the time. At the time of his arrest in November of 2020, police at a car game was in progress when Jackson entered a room, got into a fight with an individual named Warwick Williams, and fired several shots, hitting Williams twice. Don't know why he was charged with manslaughter. He may have pled guilty to manslaughter. Actually, he may have faced more serious charges to begin with. This may be another case of the justice system, you know, downgrading charges in order to obtain a conviction. But whatever the reason, I'm glad this woman is okay. I hope that Jackson does not bother his wife again. And I hope that, frankly, the wife will be filing divorce papers very soon, as well as perhaps an order of protection. And I'm really glad that she has a firearm and knows how to use it. Because, unfortunately, sometimes abusers don't get the message when the criminal justice system tells them to leave their victims alone. Finally, today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Some good Samaritans in Pennsylvania who helped a teenager who suffered a medical emergency while riding in his family's car. This was last Saturday. This teenager, 15-year-old Weston Hamaker, he's in the passenger seat. His mom, Janessa Broderick, is driving through Phoenixville, which is a Philadelphia suburb. Broderick said, "We're literally driving, just getting a haircut, getting ready for the homecoming dance that night, and he slumped over on me driving through town." She said, "I pulled over right away, and he was seizing pretty good." So mom, as you can imagine, frantically starts yelling for help. A woman named Lauren McLaughlin, who's a nurse, was walking her dog with her fiancé. And she said, "You know, I think during that time, I just kind of went into nurse mode." She said, "You just kind of get into a different mindset." She said, "I didn't even think twice." So she ran over. She checked Hamaker's pulse. She adjusted his position to help him breathe. A couple of seconds later, it sounds like, another good Samaritan, a volunteer firefighter, a retired volunteer firefighter named Jonathan Mount, saw what was going on. He rushes over to help. Mount said, "My wife and I were getting ready to get in the car, and we just heard this yell." He said, "I've heard it before. It's that mom yell." And he said, "I knew somebody was really in trouble, so I just jumped in the back seat. I held his head so he could breathe better." While they're working to put Hamaker in a position that he's not going to hurt himself during the seizure, another woman calls 911. Hamaker's mom said, "You know, one good Samaritan, one after another, one, two, three." She said, "They all happen to be perfect trades. A nurse, a firefighter. What else can you ask for in that moment when you are helpless?" Her son was taken to local hospital. He was released later that day. And Broderick posted her story on social media and wanted to thank the people who helped save her son. And she was actually able to find them through social media. One of the as far as I'm concerned, one of the few good uses of social media. And she said, "You know, I'm happy they didn't shy away from reuniting again." She said, "I'm happy we were able to find him and I was able to thank him." And I am too. That it is great that they were able to reconnect under much better circumstances. So again, in the right place at the right time, willing, able to do the right thing. Lauren McLaughlin, Jonathan Mount, the unnamed good Samaritan who called 911 to help this teenager in need. We thank you for your very, very good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Camp and Company. I want to thank you, as always, for being a part of the program. Be sure to check out BearingArms.com throughout the day. We're keeping you up to date on all of the latest Second Amendment news and information, including oral arguments of the Third Circuit over New Jersey's ban on so-called assault weapons and large-capacity magazines. We've got the latest on the DOJ pushing back against critics who say they're not pro-Second Amendment enough. Good news in terms of self-defense out of the state of Massachusetts, surprisingly enough, and much more. You can find it all again at BearingArms.com. If you like what you see, I'd encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold, or VIP Platinum member. We've just rolled out some great new stuff for VIP Platinum members. And if you use the promo code POTUS47, you can get 74% off your VIP membership right now. Great time to join up. And no matter what tier of support you choose, we certainly do appreciate your support. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe and be free.